Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design development. I'm Dave. Rupert with me is Chris Coyer. Chris, how are you today?
I am doing so well. Nice day.
What a wonderful another week. We're in the month of May here.
I bought a new bicycle. I feel like I have too many bicycles. I have to sell some. But I live now recently-ish in Bend, Oregon here, like up on a big hill, like really tall hill, which I feel like there's plenty of, especially in this land of fitness that I live in here, that there's plenty of people that power their way up this hill all the time. And I'm like, but it's just too much for me. As much as I like bicycling, it's very ambitious hill to climb on a daily. And I wanted to, so I bought an electric bike. I feel like that's how I'm connecting it to this technology program. It has a motor on it, and it helps me power my ass up that hill on the daily.
Oh, yeah? You got the hybrid there? That's nice. That's a good move.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And I got a kid seat on the back of it, so we can plunk around on long journeys. It won't kill me.
And I think that's crucial, right? Like, if you got to get up with the hill and with a kid, like, you're going to need some power.
Yeah.
I just bought a bike, too. A lot of my friends were like, one weekend, show up, and they're like, hey, we all bought gravel bikes off of Craigslist.
Mm.
It's like, oh, okay. I guess
gravel's
I need
funnest.
To do that. And they were like, yeah. And so I was like, okay. And then thankfully I found one and it was great. So that's a good bike. So it's a nice little
highly
hobby.
Appeals
more
to
hobbies
me.
That aren't.
I made sure that this one was very gravel capable as well, which is good. And I still keep in my regular bikes. I like normal bicycling and mountain biking as well, but just.
Yeah. Well, so I went down to the bike shop near my house, which is kind of, you know, those in Austin will know the 360 loop. It's like a bike loop that goes down this street called Mesa and then up this highway called 360, on the west side of town, or like northwest side of town. But there's a bike shop there, and I walk in, and it's owned by like an Italian guy named Nello. And he's like, I was like, hey, do you have gravel bikes? He's like, why would you want one of those? And I just was like, well, my friends have it, you know, in Austin. Because, like, he's just like, no. Or I could make you one from this, you know, $10,000 road bike. But no, you know, he almost was, like, refusing it. But I just was like, Austin is very, like, you'll be riding on a street and then, like, or a path or a trail. And then all of a sudden it'll turn to literal gravel. And so it's like you literally want a gravel bike for it because that's like the terrain. So anyway, it was like weird to convince this guy who's so in the road bike scene. And so when you start getting into bikes, you realize like this is a full-time job to know about all this stuff because there's like different brakes, different shifters, different components, different, you know, it starts just getting wild and more expensive and more expensive. And so,
Well, you're happy with it. That's good.
I got a good one. So I feel like I lucked out. The bike gods shined upon me. So I just need to take it out more. I don't have like a great regimen and schedule. This goes into probably a developer health conversation, right? But I just don't have I'm for lunch. I just go ride my bike. So
I know you really, that really would be nice, wouldn't it? It's so easy to convince myself that I absolutely just don't have time today. There's a million things vying for my attention, and it's very easy for me to fill my day with all of those things. And going for an hour bike ride is not one of them.
Here's, all right. This is the new show. Okay. We're just like complaining. I think this all touches on dev problems. Like, the other day I got a phone call and it was like, hi, this is State Farm. You haven't paid your homeowner's insurance policy and it's due today by midnight or else like you don't have house insurance. And I was like, oh no, like how'd I miss that? You know, like I think I'd seen a bill for it come through, but I obviously didn't act on it. But it's just like, I was so sucked up into work tasks and things like that. Like I just didn't, you know, like I just didn't even have bandwidth to like pay my house policy, which is like keeps me in my house, you know, like I don't default on my loan or whatever. And so it was just such a shocking moment for me that I like went into Notion. I love Notion, right? Went into Notion and wrote down every responsibility I could think of on like a daily, a weekly, a monthly, a quarterly, and an annual basis.
Ooh.
And just like wrote down every single thing I think I am responsible for in my life, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I have kids. Not all that stuff was on there, but, you know, like.
A lot of it was, though. Like, you know, I don't know.
It's a lot of work stuff, you know. It's like, stand up for this team, or this project has this thing, or this project has, you know. So it's like, you know, it's just, you know, my mind was melting. And so it was like, okay, I need to, like, quantify this, because I'm obviously drowning if I, like, am defaulting on my, like, homeowner's policy, you know. And so I just, it was a bit of, like, an embarrassing moment for me. But it all factors into this exercise stuff, too. It's like, I don't have time. I don't even think, like, hey, I have 2 minutes. Or 20 minutes, I should go for a little bike ride. Like, I just think, like, oh, I should check Twitter and make a joke, you know. It's like, that sucks. So what do I do? Like, so I don't know. It's all kind of factoring into, like, this, like, developer health thing, you know. Like, how do we do all the things we do and do work and, like, you know, I just don't know. So,
well, it's the most painful when you feel like your aspirations are at odds. Like, you're like, mm-hmm. I want to be the kind of guy who says he goes mountain biking every day, because that's just so cool. Like, why did I choose this life that I get to make all the choices in my life? And, you know, I don't know, I'm trying to be entrepreneurial and make it in this world. If that doesn't also equal some, like, interesting freedom, you know, but instead, like, mm-hmm. this choice, it's almost like the people I know who just work 9 to 5s have way more freedom and do way more interesting things than I do and aren't pulled 1,000 directions all the time. And so, you know, so I have these aspirations to, like, heavily succeed in business and be as good of a manager as I can be and get the best out of people that I think I can be and just have all these goals that I want to achieve. And have all these, like, life goals that have nothing to do with business. They're family goals and health goals and friendship goals and things. And they fight each other. And it sucks that they have to.
You know? Yeah, because there's, like, a limited amount of time, right? You know?
Yeah.
And you just literally can't fill up anything. And I just, you know, I think about things like Agile or whatever, right? Like, clearing tickets off a Jira board. It's like, I think that only works if you are, like, an employee of one, like, you work for one company on one team and, like, have a very limited set of objectives that you're trying to accomplish in that team, you know. Like, otherwise it's like so much stress to have, like, 60 issues in the backlog, you know, like, just waiting for you. Like, you finish this issue, guess what? You got another one, you chump, you know. Like, that's, like, so much stress to, like kind of bear. I mean, you can survive it and pace it and, you know, say, like, I only care about what's actually on here. But then I feel like you don't see the holistic product. Like, you like, lose sight of, like, the whole entire product if you're just looking at the board. So that's sort of, like, again, very specific to my life. But I just, like, how do you accomplish this? I don't know. How do you meet these goals is sort of the question. So, I don't know. So I took all my responsibilities and I just wrote them out, because I just was like, this is what I want to do. And, like, I'm going to consider biking a responsibility. Who knows if I'll get to it, but at least, like, hey, I have a responsibility. I think the next step would be, like, I'm going to schedule time on my calendar to, like, go bike, and maybe I'll stick to it. So,
good luck to us all in these tricky times. This is we got one from Kurt Petrick who's asking specifically about a JavaScript API. He asks, is it ever okay to use the .innerHTML method on an element? I understand that you would never want to display anything the user generates using innerHTML, since it can lead to cross-site scripting attacks that use innerHTML to update the DOM directly. Meaning, like, if you wrote a really basic application that, like, had an input in it and you typed Chris into it and all that you did was grab that value and enter HTML in it to some H1 tag somewhere, or, like, save that to a database and showed that to your friend in a chat app, that, yes, that is an XSS vulnerability, because I couldn't just write Chris. I could write crisp end script tag, start script tag, you know, alert cookies, you know. So certainly, yeah, when you're just jacking stuff into the DOM, which is something that the inner HTML method is for, that you do have some XSS stuff to be thinking about. So he goes on to ask, you know, One thing I've tried is creating a container element with, you know, dot create element instead, and then using inner HTML on the container to create child elements, you know, like, I guess you're working with kind of like a document fragment at that point or some kind of in-memory element temporarily. And then add classes and do all that stuff. And then just do like one inner HTML at the end to like, or like a pen child or whatever to do it. So I guess you're kind of avoiding inner HTML if you do all the creation of elements and stuff and then append it at the end. So I think Kurt is just like afraid of inner HTML. Like maybe he's read something or something that suggests that this particular JavaScript API is just dangerous to use for various reasons. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think you're right to kind of be a little hesitant, right? Because you think about like Facebook, they actually renamed React in React. It's not inner HTML. It's dangerously set inner HTML or something like that.
Right.
So like that's the API because it's basically like, hey, you can like, it's okay. Like if you have a piece of trusted DOM that, I don't know, you wrote, I guess, like, or got returned from an API, like in theory, I think you could just chuck that in there. But if you're just like, hey, user, write whatever, and we'll just spit it out on page. I mean, CodePen's probably an amazing example of this, right? Like a JS app that you write whatever code you want and it'll spit it out on the page. Like that's can be dangerous. So, in general, I think you just kind of have to, you know, be like, you have to be careful with that. This is like where, you know, formats like Markdown really shine. You know, it's like,
yeah,
you don't have like a WYSIWYG writing HTML. It just writes Markdown, which then you parse or translate on the server side. But even on the client side, you may want to use like a Markdown filter or something. So
I don't know that like create element and append child and stuff is inherently automatically safer in any way. They're not, that's not, I don't think that's a false statement.
Yeah, I tried to remember, but there's a new thing called insert adjacent HTML or whatever, which is supposed to be like a replacement for kind of just inner HTMLing or insert adjacent element.
But it feels like wherever you chuck new stuff into the DOM, like there's re-rendering is like going to happen. And none of those APIs promise you that what you're injecting to the DOM is safe.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff is on you. I mean, maybe there's other problems with inner HTML that don't immediately come to mind, but I feel like to have some trepidation, like you said, is good. Of course you should, you know, even data from an API, even from your own database, you should be careful about what you just toss onto a page. You should probably have some safety mechanisms for that. But these are really low-level APIs. This is as low as it gets for manipulating the DOM in JavaScript in the browser. So other things use that. I'm sure somewhere in React's code is it inner HTMLing things sometimes, or maybe there's some new way to do it. But it's like you have to use this stuff. It's not like this APA is automatically bad. I think that would be irresponsible for us to say, oh, you saw inner HTML in a tutorial. It's time to leave a comment that says that's dangerous and should never be used. You know, I don't know that there are any JavaScript APIs that just get a blanket, like don't use it. Occasionally, like what's a really bad one? Like document.write or whatever. I think that one's pretty ubiquitous in the like, this is so problematic for websites that it maybe should be outright banned. But I don't think inner HTML is on the outright ban list. It's on the know what you're doing list.
You know, a good thing would be like something like a to-do app or whatever. Like, I think you have to learn how it works. Like, you know, if you can type a script alert hi in your like in a to-do task, and then the website when it renders your alert, it now just says hi. Like, you have a problem. So, in like the trick is like escaping that data. You know, like you need to kind of like, okay, I have a user input box. So anytime somebody types into this, I need to make sure I like escape it either when I save it to the database or save it to the object in memory. Or both. Yeah. I mean, just make sure you like there's, what is the saying in security land? Like, just like you basically like never trust a user, you know? You know, I think we all like do that like ideal state, like, oh, you know, last week? We were like, oh, we're doing play dates, right? Like we made a play date app for our friend. You know, I think everyone's like, oh yeah, like I think you just have to be in a more like defensive posture for any kind of user input and like assume somebody's going to try to hack this Playdates app or, you know, post something not safe for work or malicious or, you know, like you just have to kind of assume that posture. You can't just assume the best of people. So I think that's like just kind of how it goes. That's almost just responsibility 101, you know, in both design and development. You can't just be naive about it. So you have to be, you know, cognizant and ready for that.
It's a good way to put it.
An Event Apart is the premier web design conference for UX and front-end people just like you. Each event they put on is 3 days of design, code, and content for interaction designers and developers, packed with tips, techniques, and insights into the future from industry shakers and shapers. If you've been in the past, this year they've adjusted things so that all of their shows in 2019 will be 3 days long with at least 17 speakers for each. And if 3 days is too long to be away from home or the office, they also offer 1 and 2 day conference passes as well. The next event coming up is in Washington, D.C. from July 29th to July 31st. There'll be folks like Jeffrey Zeldman, Sarah Parmenter, Eric Meyer, Rachel Andrews, Jen Simmons, Sarah Drasner, Laura Marchini, and a guy named Dave Rupert and more, all giving talks loaded with information to help you just build websites. They've also got conferences coming to Chicago, Denver, and San Francisco. For full details and registration information, visit aneventapart.com today. Our thanks to An Event Apart for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Dan Shields, I guess, writes in here. What does he have to say?
Dan writes in, it's easy for me to understand that adding an ARIA label makes the page more accessible, but understanding what the ARIA label should be is more difficult. Mm. For instance, is it best practice to use the ARIA label for different information than it would be in an alt tag or an image or a title tag on a link? Should the ARIA label read more explicitly? Example, a photograph of blah, blah, blah document in a case or versus blah, blah, blah document 1919. So Dan's looking for kind of best practices around.
So there's there's an attribute. It's an HTML attribute. It's ARIA-label. What does it do, Dave?
So ARIA-label is cool because it is the label that the screen reader will read. So, you know, if...
Like, isn't it rather powerful? Like it overrides what otherwise would be said for that.
It's sort of like, it's like text important, is how it works.
All right. I'm closing my eyes.
So close your eyes and like, where I'm going to be the screen reader, right? And we're going to go through, your, homepage. Ready? Mm-hmm. Click here, click here, click here, click here, click here, click here.
Yeah.
Like, that's not helpful, right? So visually it probably makes sense because like the it's like, you know, some product and then you're saying like click here, and so it's like, oh, that makes sense because it's all kind of tied together visually, right? But aurally, especially in this podcast medium, it is not connected together. So, you know, you would want it to basically, you'd want to like use ARIA label there on the button because that's kind of, you need to understand how people navigate with screen readers. There's ways to navigate screen readers just by show me all the links on the page that, or show me all the form elements or form buttons.
Yeah. Like, so instead of, if you put ARIA label on an A link that says click here and you write in there, you know, I don't know, go sign up for a product, when you tab to it or get focus on it, it will not say click here, right? The click here is gone.
Yeah. So, you know, let's say it's a pizza website. It would say like view pepperoni pizza, view sausage pizza, view, you know, meat lover pizza, you know, like it. So like there's a way you can like eject more information, even programmatically, like from a database, like, you know, it's kind of like you have to kind of be like, okay, how can we, you know, do it a little better. And like an accessibility purist might say like, well, all those buttons should be like, shouldn't just say click here. And I think they're maybe right in most cases, But, you know, real world, like, you know, you don't get to decide the label on the button text. So, but you want to do a good job. So ARIA Label is awesome for that. One limitation of ARIA Label is it's not translatable.
I've heard this. Yes, right. Because it's an attribute, not actual content or whatever. At least that's how.
Right. And I would hope Google Translate can like fix that or whatever. But you know, if you go to a foreign language page and in Google, it says like, "Hey, this is written in German. Do you want to translate this to English?" And you say, "Yeah, of course," because I'm not good at German. So, but any ARIA label would still be in German, the native language of that page. So, I would hope that this can eventually get fixed. You know, like on the tech side, because that's like a kind of an arbitrary limitation there, but it does make sense. You know, it's just concerning itself with the text. But
yeah, well, I've heard that, you know, and I learned this from Sarah Swaydan just recently, you know, because there's, let's say that, let's say the use case for this is an SVG icon and you need to put a label on it because you're not putting text next to it. I mean, usually the correct answer with iconography or whatever you might want to say is to put a word next to it. That's the interactive element. And the icon is just there visually to kind of, because it's a nice design and might enhance some understanding and whatever. Every website in the world uses icons. So I don't think I necessarily need to defend them, but let's say that you don't have room aesthetically, it's not what you want to do or something. And that this is a standalone icon that's interactable. And so hopefully that's not confusing anybody, but let's say then that you focus it with assistive technology, you could use ARIA Label on that SVG that says hamburger menu or, you know, open menu or toggle menu or something, so that it's labeled so that when you're focused on it, it says what it's going to do, which is an improvement. But there's two ways you could do it. You could use ARIA Label or you could use ARIA Labeled By. An ARIA Labeled By then takes a selector that it's going to point to, probably the ID of an element that exists kind of within it. And in the SVG land, you can say ARIA Labeled By the title element. And then in the title, you could put toggle menu. And now it's not an attribute anymore. So it will be translated. Yeah?
Yeah. See, that's like a trick, right? Like,
yeah. Which opens up the question of why would I ever use ARIA Label if ARIA Labeled By allows for translation in a way. And it's, you know, I think somebody asked Sarah that at the conference and she had a very eloquent answer to that. So I think watch the Smashing Magazine San Francisco 2019 show to hear her answer that. But it was, you know, one of the answers was, well, sometimes I'm a little lazy or it's just a, you know, that kind of thing. But she had a better answer than that. And now I forget what it was. So sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely check that out. Yeah. It's ARIA Labeled By is pretty cool. I think the weird part is it uses IDs, you know, and you're like, oh, I have to put like an ID on this little piece of text.
Like, yeah. Okay. Right. Like what do you point it to, a span that you then visually hide and it becomes a little like ergonomically tough. But is it always an ID? I feel like in SVG land, you just put ARIA Labeled By title. And then the title. No, but it does. You have to put then like ID title on the title element, right? To point to it properly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, but it's not, that's not the end of the world, you know? Like, so, and that I would say, you know, title tag on a link, Dan mentioned, that's kind of an anti-practice. It was very popular a long time ago, but people abuse that so much that screen readers kind of quit reading the title tag on an anchor link. So that doesn't even work anymore. So you need to have like text in a link. If you have a link with an image inside and the image has alt text, it'll read that alt text as the label. So like the tree kind of goes down and says like, oh yeah, this link's label is the alt text on the image. So that's cool. Not all images need alt text or they need the alt attribute.
What about this? He's kind of asking about should an image have an ARIA label on it? And I'm like, I think not, right? Like that's what the alt text
image,
is?
Yeah, that's what alt is for. So I would use tried and true alt. But, you know, Dan specifically asked, like, should it read explicitly, like a photograph of blah, blah, document in a case? The advice I've heard is you don't need to say a photograph of or a screenshot of or a, you know, picture of. Like, people get it. Like, the screen reader just said image. You know, like it just said image, a photograph of blah, blah document. It's like, yeah, duh, it's like, you know, an image. So like, it would be better to be like image, blah, blah, document 1919. Like, and then if the user is more curious, like, okay, I'll go like look up blah, blah document. But I think if, you know, but if there's, you know, more context that you're trying to get, like, oh, look how ragged this constitution is. It's all falling apart. You know, like, you know, you could say tattered constitution, you know, 1919 or whatever. That would be a little more descriptive. Like if there's adjectives you're trying to pull out of that thing, like do that. Sometimes if it's text, screenshots of text, you'll want to just kind of relay the text. Like two people talking, one says this, one says that, or something like that. There's, you know, it's tough, you know, and how far do you go? You know, like, do you explain the whole GIF? Like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld awkwardly leaving a theater, you know, unimpressed or something, you know, like what, how far do you take it? And I think it's kind of up to your judgment. Like, what information does the user need from this image? So it's tough, but you know, I think if you do a good job, you win over customers, would be what I say. So.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Discover.bot. Discover.bot is an online community for bot creators designed to serve as a platform agnostic digital space for bot developers and enthusiasts of all skill levels to learn from one another, share their stories, and move the conversation forward together. Discover.bot was built by Amazon Registry Services, and it's an informational place for novices and experts in the bot development space. Discover.bot regularly publishes how-to guides and the latest bot building resources. Some recent guides are how to design a bot personality, how to set up payments through your bot, and how to stop shopping cart abandonment. Discover.bot also shares expert advice and provides insights on all things bots. For example, what KPIs are worth measuring, why emojis may be breaking your bot, and how to write an engaging chatbot dialogue. They cover all sorts of topics and genres, including bot development, bots for business, chatbot news. If you're new to the bot development space, Discover.bot will teach you everything there is to know about bots. There's a guide called Beginner's Guide to Bots, which will teach you how bots were invented, the basics of how bots work, what bots can do, and where bots are developed and published. And if you've already got a few bots of your own, Discover.bot can help you choose a framework that's aligned with your business. For example, e-commerce, travel, finance, hospitality, and more. They've got a great guide just for you called Guide to Bot Building Frameworks. From NLU features to platform connectors to APIs, there's a lot to consider. Find out what all the major frameworks have to offer so you can choose a chatbot framework that fits your objectives. To find out more, go to discover.bot/shoptalk so they'll know you came from us, and check out discover.bot. Our thanks to discover.bot for sponsoring Shop Talk Show.
Let's do another one, shall we?
Sure.
Will Luce said he's got a his first senior developer job at a company. Congratulations, Will. And the company itself is moving from like a move fast and break things kind of thing, like, deliver all the code, let's get market share phase, to growing up a little bit. And he says, now we need a professional code base phase. So it's an Angular site, he says. I don't know if that matters. Maybe we'll think about that. Maybe we won't. And he says the things that need to change are somewhat obvious. Like, let's add tests. Let's reduce duplicate code. Let's clean up logic where we can. But I keep finding that I'm asking myself the same question. Here's that question. How can I prove that one version of the application is better than another? Like, that my change has improved this to be a more professional code base than it was before. As of now, there are no metrics being gathered that I can use to drive my decisions on what needs to change. I don't believe that there's a need to change something on a hunch, or because the community says I should, or that there's chatter that one framework is better than another, or whatever. I'd like to hear how you would approach this problem. I am fascinated by this. You know, it does seem obvious to reduce duplication and write a test for something and clean some things up. But some of these things are a little at odds with each other. I'd say that adding a test on top of existing code is just a straight up improvement,
because you're just verifying that something works. You're adding some new code that doesn't touch the code that you've already written. You're just making sure that it doesn't break in the future. So I'd say that's great. But to just go in and be like, I'm going to change up this logic just to a way that I think is better and more logical, that to me seems in the territory of just like danger for danger's sake, almost. Like, I understand complicated logic being a problem and something that it's heavily desirable for desires to clean up, but it's dangerous, you know? Like, maybe wait for it to break and then fix a bug when it does? I don't know. Like, I want to pass this to you in a minute because I think this will be fascinating, but I wanted to share a little anecdote of, and I'm just stealing this from Twitter. I can't remember who said this, but it was somebody who says, instead of referring to code as legacy code, they refer to it as legendary code because it should be honored for doing its job for long. It's battle-worn code, you know? Maybe it's not as beautiful as you think it was, but it's been doing its job, probably. If it hasn't been doing its job, sure, great, fix it, refactor it. But to change something for change's sake because you think it's a version of growing up, I think maybe growing up is knowing when not to refactor code.
You know? I have a lot of thoughts on this. Where do I start? So there was a great post by Dean Almar from Google Chrome called The Doomed Rewrite. I can put a link here in the show notes. It's a good story because he works with companies through Chrome, like helping them with their perf, you know. And basically he's like, what happens if you do the rewrite and it's not better? Like, it's slower. It's worse. It's not even easier to work with, you know, like you're like, oh yeah, we made a prototype and the prototype's awesome. So like, therefore it's like better. And therefore we should like go all in on this, you know, but like you get there and it's like, yeah, it's even harder to work with. Like we, you know, like Webpack keep breaking on us or something. We have to, you know, do everything all over, you know, like there can be other problems you don't know about yet, that make it even worse, you know? So like the rewrite doesn't always result in success. And I think that's like an important thing to realize. And in that post, he references the Monty Hall rewrite by Alex Sexton. And Alex Sexton is referencing the Monty Hall problem, which is this idea of like, you are on Let's Make a Deal and I show you three doors and you know, Chris, pick a door. Behind one of these doors is a Ferrari.
Yeah.
Okay, one. Okay, there's a goat.
Aww.
Womp womp. Would you like to keep the, or maybe it's not a goat. Maybe it's a Cuisinart. It's a new blender, Chris.
Yeah.
A new blender. Would you like to just keep this new blender or pick another door? That's your choice. Pick another door. One has a Ferrari and one has a goat. Which would you like to do? But you have this Cuisinart locked in. Which would you like to do? You know, would you like to stay at the Cuisinart or would you like to pick another door?
I'm going to pick another door.
Okay, well, you made the right choice. So the idea there is you had three options, right?
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three, and you opened the door and now you know one of your options, right? And so now it's just a bet, like either you're going to win or you're going to lose. So, but you've now seen a third of the board. So you now kind of have a even better odds. Yeah. It's kind of weird probability thing, but now you have better odds of winning because you've seen more of the board, you know?
I love this.
It's a weird like statistics thing, but so the statistics say you're better off at picking a door, even if you lose. Like the statistics prove out that you have a better chance of winning if you open the next door. So
is one of the doors like a pit of despair at some time? Cause I feel like I kind of can't lose. I'm either going to get a goat, a Ferrari or a Cuisinart. And I'm kind of cool with any of them really.
Yeah. And the Cuisinart's kind of what you have,
yeah.
You know, like it's kind of the thing you already have. And then, and Alex's thing is like, kind of maybe just go for the rewrite because like you have, a chance of winning, you know, like getting out of your technical debt. And that was my, that's my feeling right now, like working on this legacy Java app, like we are at the point where the tech debt is exploding in our faces, and like knowledge has loss has happened, and people have left and don't know, you know. So like we're hitting that point where it's like, okay, we need to actually make a huge change. And who knows if it's going to, you know, maybe Angular isn't going to be fast enough, but we'll, you know, like we need, something needs to change because we need to update this. I think rewriting for rewriting's sake isn't good. Like, is there incremental improvements that you can do? That would be one thing. But like you need to kind of improve things. Who was it? It was a Carolina Schuster, who wrote about, technical debt. Is that right?
Oh yes. There was Fox.
Yes. I murdered your last name, Caroline. I apologize. But, I was trying to find this post cause it was on Medium, and I believe
it might've been on a company blog though. Wasn't it?
Company, I don't know. Oh, this is getting even harder.
Sorry.
Anyway, at Fox on Twitter wrote about technical debt, and you know, it was a good point. I felt like she was saying like, a lot of the times we call things technical debt and they're not, you know, it's just, you're just saying, I don't like it. It's actually not, that's not technical debt. Like technical debt is kind of a, like, you know, going back to the original definition, it's like you said, I'm going to make a shortcut here. I'm going to like borrow like from the future right now. Like I'm going to make a shortcut and borrow from the future,
right,
stability or, best practices or the ability to code myself out of the problem from the future. So that's technical debt. Like you've willingly made a decision to code fast and break things, and now you have to
re-. Yeah, I feel like I almost need a better understanding of it, because I throw it around pretty regularly because it feels pretty real to me at CodePen this far in, is that we're fighting some of it but still experience plenty of it, and kind of our decision making I feel like is guided by technical debt sometimes. You know, I had a bug this morning came in where somebody was looking at a pen in full page view and their regular view, but it used some like a kind of like a complicated combination of features, and they were comparing it to a different one. I was trying to, you know, the staff was kind of looking at the bug and trying to figure out what it was. And it kind of came down to that there's like a couple of different ways that this pen can be rendered. And in one way, the logic just didn't account for this weird combination of technologies in a way that the other way that the pen can be rendered did. So why do we have two ways to render a pen at all? Why is there two different views that do this? The fact that there was at all was an early version of technical debt, which was that, oh, this is just, you know, we need to, I don't know, this solves some now problem to have these two views because it's somehow easier to get done. And now us looking at that now, I'd call it technical debt. The debt is that there's two ways to view this pen, and they're fighting each other and there's inconsistencies between them. The fact that there's two of them at all to me feels like the definition of technical debt, and that to refactor this is to make it one view such that these type of problems can't exist because there's either a bug or there's not. It's not this like, oh, there's bugs sometimes and there's not. The sometimes bugs being the worst kind of bugs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I consider that technical debt too. I mean, I think Carolina's view is maybe more strict on like what is and isn't. But I think what she's driving at too is this idea of like bad design, like putting out a bad design or something isn't technical debt. That's just doing bad. You know what
right.
I mean? So she's kind of like, Please don't call being bad technical debt. Like you made bad decisions and you need to now dig out from your bad decisions. So I think I like that. But yeah, for me, technical debt is like when you're afraid to like work on it, and afraid is sort of a subjective term, but just like people just kind of avoid it or don't want to refactor it because or fix it or even work on it because it's just such a gnarly little piece. Like that to me is kind of technical debt to me, just because it's like it's like, okay, that's something we coded and the rules around it aren't very like, you know, clear, that like that's, or the tests aren't there or something. So like it's kind of, that to me strikes me as like the like kind of technical debt. We made a choice to write this without really documenting what it does or why it does it. So that's technical debt. So Anyway, I would say it sounds like maybe you did, Will, you moved fast and broke things. And so maybe it really is helpful to clean things up. I will say, just in my recent experience, like adding tests is big, especially for refactoring. So you know that when you fix something, like it'll be easier to fix something with those tests in place. You don't have to like go and ask like, hey, what'd this thing do again? Like you have the tests in place. So, and who is it? I'm blanking on her name. Oh, she's a Rails developer, Rubyist.
Sandy
is very good. Sandy Metz.
Yeah.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Metz?
I don't know, but I've read a bunch of her work somewhat recently because of how good she is at like identifying complexity. She's very like writes very boldly about this. Be like, I can look at your app and know what breaks based on metrics, which I feel like is baller. And she's probably right.
I've watched so many Sandy Metz talks on YouTube. I go look up any of them. And she just kind of walks through like refactoring and like gives you like practical tips on how to dig out of bottlenecks and stuff like that. Like, yeah, baller is the perfect way to describe it because you're just like, I want Sandy to come and fix my code. Like, how can I please have that? So, so she's really good at it. So I definitely recommend that you go and find any YouTubes you can with her. So
that's great. Good luck, Will. I think you got your head on your right shoulder. I feel like that's an irony. I was thinking about this in the last episode too, about how people that write into the show with their thinking about the problems they're experiencing are almost inherently on their way to solving those problems already. And that it's nice for us to talk about and for us to, you know, hopefully we can be helpful sometimes. I think we're probably generally more helpful to the random listener of this problem than the person who actually has the problem themselves. Because I feel like sometimes people write in and then miss us talking about them. Because unfortunately, we don't send you a email receipt saying when we're going to answer your show and in what episode and at what timestamp. You know, you kind of got to just listen for it.
That would be pretty nice if we did that. So we'll have to, maybe we can figure
it out. It would be good. Whatever. Like the fact that you're thinking about these things and writing up your thoughts on them in the context of sending us a question, I hope is like unlocking some thinking for you anyway. So good luck with that.
Yeah. Thank you listeners for writing in because A, that gives us something to talk about, but B, I think it helps too to share your problem can help like other people can benefit from like, I guess, hearing your problems, like in knowing they're not like in the same boat by themselves. So I think that's very helpful. I also like, I wish I don't do this, but I wish I did more is just ask whatever question I have on Stack Overflow. I don't have that skill and I wish I did because I do like use chat rooms and for like lazy web or Twitter for lazy web questions, but man, I wish I just would go to Stack Overflow and be like, why is this thing weird? You know, like,
yeah, especially if it's straight up a question, because then you're contributing to the knowledge base of the world. And thank God enough people do that it's already pretty nice anyway. But yeah, I work with Cassidy Williams. I feel like Cassidy does that all the time. She has some muscle memory to just be like, oh, here's a problem we're having. I'm just going to write it up quick and throw it on Stack Overflow. And how many times have you landed on a Stack Overflow that doesn't have 692 upvotes? It has like 2, but it's still useful, you know?
Yeah, all the time. Well, and then you don't like you're just documenting your problem almost, you know, like you can still work on it and think it through, but you've just said like, hey, here's a backup plan. Like I've initiated protocol X. Somebody will maybe answer my question in 1 to 5 days or something like that. You know, like or at least give us a direction on it. So, you know, that's kind of killer. So especially if like you're, you know, you're slightly out of your wheelhouse on, you know, a Rails app or a Nuxt app or something like that. I wish I just was a little more bold. You know, I think like Stack Overflow got popular just after I like started learning. Does that make sense? Like my learning phase, my 3-5 years of learning, like intense, like it started like right after that. So I need to don't know. I wish it was more of a habit is what I'm saying.
I like it. Let's ask a Stack Overflow question. It's almost like a power center of that kind of thing. And nobody kind of talks about it that way, which is fine because I think it's a great company and whatever. But, you know, the fact that you're saying that and not saying just like ask the question on your blog with your comment thread or something is like, it's kind of us just saying like, no, like maybe a power center is good in the land of a developer hive mind.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
Dangerous. Unless anyhow. They do something super shady or whatever, which I don't know that they have so far, at least in my knowledge, which is something to say to be around for that long and not have screwed
not
the pooch.
Have some kind of venture capital scandal.
Yeah.
So maybe we just don't know yet, but all right.
Oh, this is an interesting one from Victoria Radishkova. She's been at her job for 12 years and writes, I know in this industry is suicide. I'm like, uh-oh. Is it really? to like
a Paravel just hit the 12 year mark.
Well, it feels like, you know, what did we learn recently that the average time to spend as a developer in Silicon Valley is a year? Or was it less
something
than a
like
year?
That, yeah.
I don't know. But even a year feels like, really? That's the, as much dedication as you have to these companies? Okay, I guess. Maybe there's something weird with career ladders, you know? But to be at a 12 years, I would think, like, doesn't that prove that you're super loyal and you get bonus points for that? Maybe not these days. I don't know. I would value it. I think that's cool, Victoria. Anyway, so I found that there's just – and I love this question because this is what I've been, like, talking about in my conference talks recently. I found that there's no such thing as a web designer anymore. You're either a UI UX designer, purely visual, or a web developer, in which case that you need to know Angular or React or something as a must. And that the she's finding this kind of middle ground not a thing anymore. So looking for a job has been super challenging, starting with the job title. I've seen so many titles that just don't even make sense, like UI technologist, UI engineer, UI developer, and sometimes things like senior web engineer that somehow doesn't require JavaScript. So I feel almost embarrassed if I dare to call myself a front-end developer not being particularly fluent in JavaScript. I really don't know what I am, which is HTML, CSS, and some JavaScript, and some design sensibility, you know, like a front of the front, I think.
Yeah, this is where it gets tough. I mean, this is the sort of the thing, like front of the front end or back of the front end or... This is sort of the great divide kind of, but from the perspective of somebody who's been like nose of the grindstone for 12 years and like lifts their head up, like maybe I do want a new job or, you know, I'm not saying looking for a job exactly, but just like is now like, oh geez, what happened? Like my job doesn't exist anymore. Like that's wild. You know, like
it is wild.
There's not people who just make websites anymore.
Is it really true is the thing? Like maybe it is, but it seems like, it seems like it may not be. I don't know. There's so many. Victoria, just know that you're not alone. I've heard from countless people in this situation through, you know, emails that we gotten after we did the How to Think Like a Front-End Developer series and from the conference talk that I've been giving, How to Think Like a Front-End Developer, in which that I've been giving all over the place and kind of pointing to this divide of like these heavily JavaScript-focused style of developer and then whatever everybody else is that just has a whole bunch of interesting skill set stuff except for that. And it seems like there's almost more of you, Victoria, than there is, you know, truly JavaScript focused people. But and I don't even know what to make about that, except for that in the talk, I point to the idea that the hiring thing is the biggest pain point for people, that people are taking it personally because there's nothing more personable than like being able to provide for yourself and your dependents and not being able to get a job because of like skill sets requirements kind of moving underneath your feet, even though you feel like a competent get stuff done kind of person, that being able to not get a job because of, you know, some lack of, you know, what seems like a brand new skill is weird.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are companies who just want a web developer. I think like, you know, or front end web designer, you know, I think they just maybe don't know, or maybe you have to kind of put your, like, I feel like we had a question recently or perhaps last week. It was just like, hi, I'm a designer who does code. Like I feel like so many people have trouble like translating their like designs into code. Like there's enough bottlenecks there. I feel like this should be a discipline or some kind of word for it, some sort of like UI, but can code or something, you know, but then like you get into UI developer and it's like, oh, okay. I'm, you know, whatever. I'm 20,000 node modules deep on this UI, you know, and you're like, me, do we need that? But so, you know, but maybe it is a chance for you. I think I'm picking up, like, I almost feel embarrassed to call myself a front-end developer, not being fluent in JavaScript. Maybe it's like half like the great divide, but half like, hey, like, I think you've exposed some gaps in your knowledge. So I think maybe it's time to fatten up those T's. That's a post by Mark Otto. If you can fatten up those T's, like your shape of knowledge can kind of fill out. Mm-hmm. I think like that's a really like important thing. I think like, you know, if you just are skilled, fatten up the T analogy is like basically like you have a baseline skill of everything that's a lower, like think of a graph that's like the bottom, right? And then you have one skill that's really good. And so you have a bar chart in the middle that's poking straight up. It's like an upside down T. Mark's point is kind of like, well, maybe like you start taking that skill in the middle and try to make it like the things complementary next to it wider and wider and wider. So like maybe you've exposed a deficit in your JavaScript knowledge. So maybe try to fill that up. So I think Wes Boss's JavaScript courses are always good for that. He has like a just ES6, ES7 JavaScript course, teaches you all the new stuff in JavaScript. And I found that to be a really good way, even though I know some of that stuff, I found it to be a good way to kind of like catch up on like, okay, this is actually everything that's kind of new. So that was helpful for me just to round out my understanding.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't have time. And Dave Rupert, LLC, we were talking about time at the top of the show. Like Dave Rupert, LLC doesn't have time to be like, what's every new API in ES6, 7, and 8? Like, let me just go through, let me just cruise MDN, you know, like by chronological order. You know, I don't have time for that. So it's pretty helpful to have like, you know, resources, CSS tricks or stuff Wes does to kind of like round out those knowledge gaps, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, this, we'll just finish up with this last one by Sam, who's asking, Sam Culper is asking, or he says that he's found this series of blog posts called Base CS, CS being computer science, that covers the basics of computer science, such as binary and data structures. And he finds them really interesting. But someone with only front-end experience, I'm wondering if my time is better spent learning about React or Vue or just general JavaScript stuff more deeply. So, you know, and Sam's saying what he wants to work on is complex web apps, not just brochure sites or whatever. So he wants to understand fundamental data structures and things like that. He wants to be a front-end developer, but just, you know, working on more complicated things. And just kind of wonders what we think about that. I think that's fascinating because what's already happening here, again, is some self-reflection of the fact that you are reading a series of blog posts called Base Computer Science and finding them fascinating is like, well, maybe chase that horse then, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I like Vidae Joshi's blog, Base CSS. There's a podcast she does too. That's really good. It's cool because she just takes a computer science topic almost one a week, or I think that's, it sort of changed. That was the plan, I think, but then it changed. But it's kind of just like one topic, just kind of dive into it, explain it in human terms, and kind of just start kind of building knowledge there. You know, I think that's good. I think like if that interests you, like go for it. You know, I'm looking at the stuff, and this is all stuff I know or like have come across, like abstract syntax trees, ASTs, you know, and it's like I'm just like, I don't, you know, it's a good article. I'm not slagging that, but I'm saying, I'm not like provoked to like be like, yeah, let me round out my knowledge about that. So like, but if you are like, jump on it, you know, like parse trees and stuff like that. Like if that sounds interesting, like go for it. I am not like currently interested in ASTs, but I actually, now that I say that, like it's come up in conversation recently and I'm like, oh, maybe I do need to actually kind of like understand this, because like JavaScript has an AST or React has an AST or whatever. So like, maybe I do need to understand this stuff. So,
and it's not everybody that wants to go there. I mean, I think it is generally kind of valuable. I've found, I think it does come up in job postings sometimes, or it comes up in hiring discussions once in a while. I know we've had those conversations even at CodePen before, where just like sometimes the complexity of things feels very weighty and you're like, gosh, I wish there was somebody around here that like totally understood computer science so that they could swoop in here and wrap their computer sciencey brain around this problem and solve it in an elegant way that we have thus far feel like we haven't nailed, you know? And I feel like a lot of companies have that feeling internally, like, I should be nice to have somebody around here that really understood the science of these things. And maybe that's not, maybe just because you know what binary is, that doesn't unlock that knowledge in you, but it starts you on a path that maybe does let you become that person if you think very abstractly. And to some degree, it's at odds with really practical stuff. To some degree, this stuff is so theoretical sometimes that you need to spend a bunch of time in the theory of it before moving on to the practical analysis of it. And that's tricky for some people to pull off. That's what turns me off to the idea. I have no desire to do that. My focus is so wide anyway, between kind of developer outreach stuff and marketing stuff and design and practical solutions for things and thinking about features and thinking about management. And I feel like I have enough on my plate already that I can see the appeal of computer science stuff and wish I, you know, had more resources at my fingertips for that type of stuff. But it's not something that I'm going to be actively pursuing, because I'm choosing to outsource it to maybe people like you, Sam.
I mean, I think if it interests you, go for it. Like, in you know, if you get bored or it's too much, bail out, you know what I mean? So like, but it does sound like if you're like, if it seems attractive or like it is piquing your interest, like you're maybe discovering a little bit more about what kind of developer you are, you know, like you're like, maybe I am more on this, like the algorithmic side of things. I think it was Rachel, Animation Rachel. Hold on. I got it. Neighbors. There it is. Rachel Neighbors. Animation Rachel, we call her.
Yeah. Congratulations, Rachel, on your new job at React.
Yeah. So she works at React now. But she was kind of tweeting a year or two ago, but she's just kind of talking about like she got a book on algorithms, you know, and she's just like, I love this. This is this stuff I love, you know, and she comes from a very animation, you know, UI, CSS kind of background, at least maybe I'm overspeaking, but she started there and now she works on the React team doing like helping out, round out the docs and stuff like that. Like, that's awesome, right? Like, so like started kind of, you know, and not that those were, you know, separate tasks or whatever, but she just kind of was kind of live tweeting these algorithms, how much she was just enjoying learning about these like heavy computer science algorithms. And I thought that was really cool. So if it interests you, you should do it.
I love it. Listen to yourself.
Right. Yeah. Listen to that inner voice telling you what to do. Like, go eat a sandwich, get a milkshake, stuff like that. Yeah. So go for a bike.
About that time.
All right.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this new podcast of choice. Be sure to start our favorite of that's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get brand new ones. People want to hire people like you and Chris.
They sure do. In fact, they're on sale during May. They're $100 off to be on the Shop Talk Show job board, which is also the CodePen job board and CSS Tricks Show job board. We just redesigned it and redesigned the sign up flow for what it's like to post a job, making it a lot simpler and stuff. Battled some of our own technical debt, although it wasn't that heavy, but it was just to make the flow like extra smooth for people posting jobs. So yeah, we very much want you to try it out. Thus our offering $100 off all of May. So it's only $199 to post your job, and it'll run for 60 days. So if you hire somebody within those 60 days, which I very much hope that you do, then just take it down, which you can do, or edit it as needed. But, you know, it'll run for 60 days, which is cool.
And hey, Shopomaniacs, go to that job board, check it out, find jobs, post about success stories. We have employers all the time.
Yeah. It's the funny thing running a job board. It's for both people. It's like, I want you to post, but I want, it's who it's for is for people looking for jobs. So,
because we have people who write in, they're like, hey, I found a job. Just want to say thank you. That's not really a question. Just like, I found a job on the job board and through this podcast. Heck, thank you. Or we'll have employers or like, just be like, hey, we actually had too many like talented people apply, which is like a problem you don't usually have. Like, so like too many Shopomaniacs applied, and we actually so many that we have like a backlog, and we got more work and like started like part-timing people, like getting them just a little bit of work, you know, like whatever we could, just to kind of like hang on to these talented candidates. So I mean, people want to hire people like you is I don't think an overstatement. So hopefully good luck out there if you're looking for new jobs. So, all right, Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Nope, that's it. ShopDuckShow.com.